Can you hear me over the air conditioner at the back?
Yes.
It's clear? Okay. So this morning we looked at how the Buddha's awakening was an awakening to the conditioned arising of things. He was turning away from any idea of some kind of absolute reality, any notion of a permanent or an intrinsic self or soul. There's no place in this vision for anything we might translate by the word God. It's very much an encounter, an opening to the flux of life itself. And in fact, if we tried to find a word that was less technical than conditioned arising, which is a rather clumsy expression in English, we might even consider just using the word life itself, an awakening to life, the emergence of processes through conditions, through causes, and our own implication, our own embeddedness in that kind of a world. But the Buddha also realized, as we said this morning when I read out the text, that to teach this Dharma to others would be vexing and tiring. And then he goes on to say in quite a famous verse that follows that, he says, those who are caught up in attachment and hatred, who are covered by a mass of darkness, they will not see what goes against the stream, subtle, deep, hard to see and find. So he describes his teaching as something that goes against the stream. What does that mean? I think at one level it refers to the views that were currently held by people of his time, and again particularly within the Brahmin priesthood. But it also, and perhaps more importantly, goes against the stream of our own habitual instincts and drives and fears and desires. I think we see this stream, or sometimes it's called this flood. We see it when we sit in meditation, when we're given this very simple instruction, let's say just to watch the breath, or to pay attention to the sensations in the body. Very, very simple. But, as you probably discovered, that doesn't mean that it's easy. And one of the great sort of dilemma of meditators is that even when you've done this for many years, you still come into a room like this, you sit on your cushion, you bring your attention to the breath, and within a few seconds, even though you have the strongest motivation, you've had all kinds of confirming experiences of the value of such a practice, suddenly the mind is elsewhere. You're back in the past, you're off in the future, or simply you're just drifting. You've been picked up by some idea, some image, and you've just run with it. And very often we don't even notice that at its inception. It may take some minutes before we somehow wake up almost, or the bell rings, or the door shuts, and we come to and, right, yes, I'm here. Back to the breath. And I think this stream that the Buddha's teaching goes against is precisely this incessant pouring forth of thoughts, of images, of feelings, of worries, of plans, of memories. It really is very much like a flood or a stream, a current, over which we have very little control. And as soon as there is a lapse in attention, we are whisked away. There's a very good account of this in a Mahayana Buddhist text called the Bodhicaryavatara by the 8th century monk Shantideva. And he compares he compares mindfulness to the gatekeeper, the guardian at the doorway of the senses. And as soon as the guardian falls asleep or gets distracted, then immediately there's the danger that what he calls the robbers, the thieves, the bandits of inattention will then break in and steal the treasures of our mind. And he says that in his imagery here, he says it's like these bandits, like attachment, greed, fantasy, and so on, are like waiting for the moment, waiting for an opportunity when the guard is no longer at the gateway of the senses, and they will then break in. Give them any moment. And he also, elsewhere in the same text, he uses this image. He says it's like a poisoned arrow, that once it penetrates the skin, the poison will spread through the body, through the blood, very, very quickly. So you may only have a few moments of some distraction or some fantasy, but it very quickly takes over. Sometimes you can feel it even physically. Your heart accelerates. You might start to sweat slightly. There's a kind of agitation in the body itself. And such is the power of these disturbing or distracting feelings and emotions, is they readily transport us, occupy us. So the practice of mindfulness is in many ways the practice of being constantly alert to the eruption, the appearance of these kinds of thoughts and feelings that can so easily take us away into distraction, into wherever they take us. And at that moment, the mindfulness is somehow lost. And so we need to recover it. So one of the reasons for doing this practice over time, particularly in the context of a retreat, is to train ourselves to become more and more familiar, more and more attuned to this particular sensitivity, this perspective on ourselves, on our lives, so that it becomes a much more natural disposition. We have to train ourselves. It's not easy. There's a passage in the Digha Nikaya where the Buddha says, whenever a person grasps, the devil stands beside them. Or Mara. Mara stands beside them. In other words, as soon as that grip comes in, the demonic, which is that which blocks us, is that which restricts and limits and confines us, comes into play. And elsewhere the Buddha says, there is nothing as powerful in this world as the power of Mara. Nothing at all, no armies, no natural disasters are more powerful than the power of Mara. And I think this puts into perspective what it is the Buddha is in a sense suggesting that we do. this is not a sort of practice that we can do for a few weeks or months or years and then somehow realize it and go off and do something more interesting. But it is actually a way of life. It's a way we choose, if we so wish, to make into a central perspective, not only when we meditate — that's really just the training laboratory that we do on occasions like this — but it really only comes, I think, into its full effect when we manage more and more to integrate this kind of way of being into our daily lives, into our relationships, into our own understanding of our inner life, in our working with the conflicts and troubles of the world. So it's something that's going to take us, in my own case, let's say, I'm going to be doing this until the moment I drop dead, and I'll still be struggling, probably. I'll still be getting distracted and wandering off. And that, I think, is simply a measure of the kind of work we do. And for this reason, too, I think it's often even a little deceptive to place too much expectation or hope that in one day we'll get some magical experience, some mystical insight in which suddenly everything will be resolved. That may occur in some instances, but I think for the bulk of humanity, we have to consider this path, this process of waking up, this practice of the Dhamma, as ongoing, as open-ended, as a constant challenge to keep coming back and starting again, and not to fantasize and expect that by getting some sort of sudden illumination that suddenly all of these habits will fade away. And in fact, the texts are quite clear about this. The Buddha doesn't suggest that once you enter the stream of the path that all your troubles will be over. Far from it. It's simply the beginning of a longer process. I feel that the idea of impermanence, the idea of continuity, the idea of conditionality are all very much of a part with this practice of attention, this practice of awareness. And it's about really trying to enter into this stream, enter into this culture, so that it becomes more and more a feature of who we are. We'll remain the same. We'll still be Stephen and John and Mary and Francis. But we'll begin to maybe respond to ourselves, to be with ourselves, to live in this world from a slightly different perspective. The idea of conditionality is, of course, rather abstract. And in the passage we looked at today, it doesn't really say much beyond the fact that there is that we experience and we live in a world that comes and goes, that arises and passes away. This principle of conditioned arising has not yet been translated into a practice, into a structure that we can actually apply in a more concrete way. What happens next in the Buddha's teaching, if we follow the traditional way in which these events occur, is that the awakening occurs in Uruvela, which is now called Bodh Gaya. It's about another 6 weeks, 2 months, again we can't be entirely sure, but a short period of time after that, that the Buddha starts teaching. There's a story about how Brahma, this god, inspires him to go and teach. I don't want to get too much into the meaning of that little episode. But needless to say, at a certain point, he says, there will be people who could understand this. And he sets off for Benares, which even at the time of the Buddha was the sacred city of the Brahmins. And he knew that five of his former companions in asceticism were staying in a park in a little town near Benares called Isipatana, which is now called Sarnath. And he went to this park, and it's there that he started teaching. So what I want to look at is what it was he then began to say. In other words, how did he translate this principle of conditioned arising into a form of practice, something you can actually do? And as I mentioned earlier, I think the core of this practice revolves around the ideas of the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths. And this is in essence, the content of his first sermon, his first lecture. Now the text as we have it, which I have a version here, Turning the Wheel of Dhamma. This text is too refined, it's too worked for us to really imagine that this was a literal transcript of what he said. I think it quite likely that this particular text was probably worked and reworked over a long time throughout his teaching career until it achieved this kind of pithiness. There's something amazingly concise about this text. It's quite short, and yet it contains within it the very core of what the Buddha's Dhamma is about in terms of a praxis. Let me just read it out. I've translated it in a somewhat pared down way even further, in accordance with the principles I was mentioning this morning, but we can discuss the ins and outs of that later if you wish. This is what I heard, is how the text begins. He was staying at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana, and he addressed the group of five. One gone forth does not pursue two dead ends. Which two? Infatuation, or indulgence in sense pleasure, which is vulgar, uncivilized, and meaningless, and mortification, which is painful, uncivilized, and meaningless. I have awoken, he says, to a middle path that does not lead to dead ends. It is a path that generates vision and awareness. It leads to tranquility, insight, awakening, and release. It has eight branches: appropriate seeing, thinking, talking, acting, working, trying, attending, and focusing. This is suffering. Birth is painful. Aging is painful. Sickness is painful. Death is painful. Encountering what is not dear is painful. Separation from what is dear is painful. Not getting what one wants is painful. This psychophysical condition, the five aggregates, is painful. This is craving. Craving is repetitive. It wallows in attachment and greed, obsessively indulging in this and that. craving for stimulation, craving for existence, craving for non-existence. And this is cessation, the traceless fading away and cessation of that craving, the letting go and abandoning of it, freedom and independence from it. And this is the path with eight branches, appropriate seeing, thinking, talking, acting, working, trying, attending, and focusing. So is suffering. It can be known. It has been known. So is craving. It can be let go of. It has been let go of. So is cessation. It can be experienced. It has been experienced. So is the path. It can be cultivated. It has been cultivated. There arose in me illumination about things previously unknown. And as long as my knowledge and vision was not entirely clear about the 12 aspects of these Four Noble Truths, I did not claim to have had a peerless awakening in this world with its humans and celestials, its gods and devils, its ascetics and priests. Only when my knowledge and vision was clear in all these ways did I claim to have had such awakening. The freedom of my mind is unshakable. There will be no more repetitive existence. This is what he said. Inspired, the five delighted in his words. And while he was speaking, the dispassionate, stainless Dhamma eye arose in the Venerable Kondanya, who said, "Whatever has started can stop." Now, some of you may be familiar with a more literal translation of that, but I think the main points, at least in terms of how this practice can be achieved here and now, are contained in this version. To me, the really crucial point about this text is in the passage at the very top of page 4, where the Buddha describes quite explicitly what it was that constituted his becoming the Buddha, what his awakening was about. And as we saw in the previous passage, he doesn't claim that he has awoken to some ultimate truth. There he spoke of how he had awoken to this conditioned arising. And I think what he's doing here is he's now expanding that to point to precisely what sequence of conditions in fact gave rise to his experience of awakening. It wasn't just that he understood that things were conditioned. He was concerned very much and perhaps entirely with what conditionality meant in the context of his own life. And as he says here, as long as my knowledge and vision was not entirely clear about the 12 aspects of these Four Noble Truths, I did not claim to have had a peerless awakening in this world. So the awakening of the Buddha has to do with an awakening to these Four Noble Truths. And not just as four facts about the nature of life, but as he says here, entirely clear about the 12 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. Now, what are they? What are these 12 aspects? Well, we have to go back to the passage before where it says, so is suffering, it can be known, at the top of the page. That's right. So is suffering, it can be known, it has been known. So is craving, it can be let go of, it has been let go of. So is cessation, it can be experienced, it has been experienced. So is the path, it can be cultivated, it has been cultivated. So in each of those phrases, you have three elements. So is suffering, one. It can be known, two. It has been known, three. And then the same for the next three. And if your math is any good, 3 times 4 equals 12. Now this, I think, is another very good example of how the Buddha avoids using words like, I have awoken to the truth. First of all, there are four truths, not one. And then you find that the four truths are understood each in three distinct phases. And when we consider these phases, what do they boil down to? Let's take the example of suffering. First of all, the first phase is to recognize suffering. So is suffering, or such is suffering. Recognition. Secondly, it can be known. In other words, there is something you can do about it. Suffering implies an action that you can perform. You can know it. Craving, you can let go of it. Cessation, you can experience it. The path, you can cultivate it. In other words, each of these truths is he has recognized each of these truths as a task that can be performed. And then in conclusion, he acknowledges that he has completed that task. He has known suffering. He has let go of craving. He's experienced cessation. And he has cultivated a path. So there are three phases with regard to each truth: recognizing it, performing it, and completing it. So the truths here are, in terms of practice, not things to be known, simply understood in some way, conceptually or intellectually, but are actually tasks that are to be performed. And awakening, therefore, is an awakening that has arisen from the recognition, the performance, and the completion of four tasks. And I think once we go into this a little bit more, we'll find that what it's pointing to is not some fixed state of understanding, but rather it is an ongoing process of action. In many ways, I feel that the practice of the Dhamma, in a very immediate sense, leaving aside all of the theories and all of the expectations we might have of some goal, what it boils down to in the first instance is the practice of the first truth, suffering, dukkha. Dukkha is to be known. I think in the sense in which Socrates used the expression, know yourself. The word in Pali is parinya, which perhaps would more literally be translated as to fully know, to totally know. When the Tibetans translated it, it became Yong Susheba, which means a complete and comprehensive knowledge or understanding of dukkha. That's the challenge of the first truth, to really know it. And I feel that what we do when we practice mindfulness and awareness, we are in fact knowing dukkha fully and totally, opening our experience to the reality of dukkha. So let's go back to the beginning of the text where he says what dukkha is. This is suffering, he says. Birth is painful, aging, sickness, death, encountering what is not dear, separation from what is dear, not getting what one wants, and in brief, this psychophysical condition. This psychophysical condition, or these five aggregates, as they're technically called, the materiality, feeling, perception, sankhara, which means like impulses, inclinations, volitions, choices, and consciousness, that whole complex of experience is in some sense dukkha. It is shot through with pain. That does not mean, however, that the Buddha is saying that every moment of our lives is painful. That's clearly not the case. And as we saw earlier on, he recognizes that when there is a pleasant feeling, you should know it as a pleasant feeling. There's another text in the Sanyutta Nikaya where he says that the practice of the four truths is not something which is suffering and painful, but it is in fact a practice that only brings happiness and joy. There's an enormous amount of confusion around this word dukkha. It's perhaps a phrse better understood as something like the tragic dimension of life itself. And we have to be very careful not to think that this is going to lead us into a gloomy, pessimistic, negative state of mind. That suddenly we're going to stop having fun, and once we start meditating, everything becomes miserable. For a start, we all probably know that that's simply not true. The dukkha does not mean that. It's very difficult to find a word in English that captures the range of meanings implied in the word dukkha. It certainly is the word that is used to express pain, to translate or to refer to physical and mental pain. But it's also a term the Buddha uses, for example, in the phrase that sabba sankhara dukkha, all conditions are dukkha. Now, clearly, all conditions are not in physical or mental pain. This air conditioning system, this world that comes into being, that gives rise to effects, in some sense is dukkha. The material world, the emotional world, the perceptual world, the conscious world, is dukkha. In what sense is it dukkha? I think in one sense, because there's nothing in this world by possessing or by owning or by controlling that can guarantee us the sort of well-being, the sort of peace and tranquility that we deep down seek to experience in our lives. No matter how skillfully we organize the elements of our lives, we'll never get to a point where we create the perfect situation. We might spend a lot of energy, for example, in getting a nice house. And we might, as we're pursuing that goal have all sorts of fantasies about me in my nice house and all the and how wonderful it will be. And that, of course, motivates us perhaps to get it, and that might be a rather important thing for us to do. And I think to have a nice house is a very good thing, and the Buddha would not disagree. To be contented with one's lodging, he saw as one of the characteristics of a person who has become part of the noble family, as he calls it. But if we invest in that idea of the perfect house, the idea that when we're there, we won't have any problems anymore, then we're in for a bit of a disappointment. Because the perfect house will then simply become, after we've got used to it and got over the excitement of having it, it will simply become the arena for our next set of problems. And possibly also will be perceived to be not quite as perfect as we thought it was. And anybody who's owned a house will know what I'm talking about. Houses are an endless project. They keep breaking down. They keep needing to be fixed. Things keep leaking. Windows get dirty and get out of kilter, etc., 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 etc. So what the Buddha's pointing at, I think, with this idea of dukkha is that the conditions of the world cannot be trusted. They cannot be relied upon to provide us with the kind of deep, lasting well-being that we so urgently long for. We can't depend on such things. They're unreliable.